We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Television is reality, and reality is less than television.
All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Feature presentation, The Pause Button, with your host, Borzoi Boskovich.
I set the recording up. All right. We'll just wing it. Okay. I got a long quote to open this.
Why am I getting GNC ads for female athletes? What do they know about me that I don't know?
All right.
I can fancy what you saw. Yes, it is horrible enough, but after all, it is an old story. An old mystery played in our day and in dim London streets instead of amidst the vineyards and the olive gardens. We know what happened to those who chanced to meet the great god Pan, and those who are wise know that all symbols are symbols of something, not of nothing. It was indeed an exquisite symbol beneath which men long ago veiled their knowledge of the most awful, most secret forces, which lie at the heart of all things. Forces before which the souls of men must wither and die and blacken as their bodies blacken under the electric current. Such forces cannot be named, cannot be spoken, cannot be imagined, except under a veil and a symbol to the most of us appearing a quaint, poetic fancy, to some a foolish, silly tale. But you and I, at all events, have known something of the terror that may dwell in the secret place of life, manifested under human flesh, that which is without form, taking to itself a form. And this is the Pause Button, and I am your host, Borzoi. And joining me is the Thing team. We reconvened after the fall of the base in Antarctica. I got Apache with me, and I got Alex McNabb.
Thing gang. What's up? What's up, guys?
What's up?
Go ahead and do your plugs, guys. What anything you got going on? I know you got stuff going on, Apache. So I mean, Soul. I mean, everyone kind of knows who we are by now, but you know, just put it out there. You never know who it's somebody's first episode.
Yeah, well, before I plug my stuff, I just want to say I'm really excited. One of my favorite shows, The People Square, is back. So definitely go check that out. I was actually taking a cold shower right before this and listening to last night's app, catching up on that. But yeah, besides that, I am doing the Manor Bund podcast, the Manor Bund Dispatch with Nam, and that will be out every 2 weeks. Coming up this week, we've got John Q. Publius on as a guest, so you can check that out at themanorbund.com.
And for those who are unaware, The People Square is a show that I co-host with Eric Stryker. We do it live, and you can only catch it live when it's live, but with the playback MP3 can be found at therightstuff.biz. But Alex, did you want to plug anything?
Yeah, sure. I'm on the right stuff up is we do TDS. What is it? Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Friday's paintball show. And follow me on Instagram at Madman McNabb.
Yeah, you've posted some good stuff on there.
I post my legs there all the time. I haven't got my OnlyFans account going yet, but just wait.
Everyone needs to know we're normal people because we are. But
is it just going to be pictures of your legs and bathtubs?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, just hold. Just you know, stay tuned for when Alex McNabb sells his bathwater. But this week we are talking about the kind of forgotten about Christopher Nolan film, The Prestige, which came out, I think, what I was in
2006.
Yeah, 2006. I kept wanting to say 2010, but I knew that wasn't right. Yeah, 2006. Yeah, it was based off of I didn't even know it was based off a novel. I thought it was an original work of his, but I believe it was his brother and him who adapted it for a screenplay. But yeah, the Magician film, as everybody knows, the Magician film where David Bowie plays Nikola Tesla. I think that's the way most people remember it.
I didn't realize that until I rewatched it and I saw his name in the credits. It's like, oh my God, that's David Bowie playing Tesla.
Yeah, he did a good job in it too.
Yeah, no, he was great.
And yeah, I think his casting was quite deliberate, given the intersection of magic, of stage magic, and the esoteric and the occult. But that's we'll get into that a little bit later. I think because as I told you guys, I have 8 pages of notes on this. I don't even know if I'm gonna get through all this. I will be posting a companion piece on racewars.com where I'll basically detail all my research notes on this. This it kind of turned into a whole essay. But before I get into the full autism, I'll just kind of let you guys start it off with thoughts on the film.
Yeah. So I guess just to give a little introduction for people who haven't seen it, or maybe somebody who hasn't seen it in a while, this is a movie that takes place primarily in late 19th century London, two competing magicians going at each other. It's the primary plot driving the movie. We've got Hugh Jackman.
Wolverine versus Batman and on alternate Earth.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. That's really funny.
Let's go with Branson.
I also Hugh Jackman playing Angier, also known as the great Danton.
Yeah, I think it was
Dantone. And just side note, I just watched that movie Bad Education with Hugh Jackman on HBO, where he plays a gay superintendent who's like embezzling millions of dollars from this rich Long Island town to basically finance his lavish gay lifestyle. It's actually a pretty good movie. It's pretty interesting. But the other star in this is, of course, Christian Bale playing Borden. And these are two magicians at the top of their game. I don't know if McNabb, if you want to jump in, do we want to go through the summary, a quick plot summary here?
If you've never seen The Prestige, go into it fresh. And because I had a lot of fun, I figured out what was going on in the movie pretty quickly because I have a writer's mindset. So I was able to put my mindset, like if I were to reconstruct the story, how would I do it? So I figured out what was going on pretty quickly. But part of the fun in it is going in fresh and trying to figure out, well, what is the central mystery of this story?
Mm-hmm.
And then you find out, and it's kind of like, I mean, they telegraph to you what's happening. And then, I don't know. I felt this is a very Nolan-esque Nolan film. Like, it's just like maximum Nolan here. Like, kind of like, oh, wow, you've got sort of an interesting twist, and somehow you managed to turn this into 2 hours and 10 minutes of runtime. like every Nolan film, like the central idea is okay. It's kind of clever. And then it just gets dragged out and just piled on top of.
Yeah, and like many other Nolan films, such as Memento or Inception, the film is told out of order. It's not chronological. It's a lot of it is told through the character Borden, and how do you pronounce it? Is it Angier or
Angier? I don't know.
Angier. They both get each other. They both get each other's diaries, and there's some lack of truthfulness within those diaries. So the story is told through, you know, one reading the other's diary, and it's told out of order in very Nolan-esque fashion.
Yeah, it's not exactly, it's almost a meta film, but not exactly. It kind of leans on the fourth wall a bit. And I guess the way I can explain this is because the way they open it up is they explain the three-act structure of a magic. Now, this part is not actually a real aspect of magic. I actually got a whole book, by the way. If people are interested in the history of stage magic, there's a really good book that I got, and I don't know what happened to it. I had it right next to me, but it's here it is, right here. It's called
I want to say real fast, I think Christopher Nolan is a thinking man's midwit.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I like his films, but I have no disagreement with that assessment. Yeah, so this is it's called The Magic Book by Noel Daniel. He edited it. It's actually a series of essays, but what's really awesome about it is that it's not only does it go through the history of this stuff, but it's especially more than anything an art book. And so you get to see all these artistic depictions of stage magic through history. And you see, like, I just opened to some random pages. So I got like this guy that actually looked kind of like McNabb when he was doing the devil makeup. It's called Thurston, the Great Magician, the Wonder Show of the Universe. So that you get to see all of these great posters. And here's a guy who's actually dressed as a devil. Illusions, enchantments, mysteries. This is all, and they cover some of the black magic connections with stage magic and all that. So I used some reference points for this. But as I was saying, the whole idea of the pledge, the turn, the prestige, that's not really stage magic terminology. That's more of a Hollywoodism. And you can tell, like, this is them more describing the three-act structure of storytelling of every magic trick has a third act. I mean, they kind of give it away that this is, they're explaining how this how the structure of this movie is actually working. And that part I actually kind of found neat, because it does what fits, and actually, by the way, for magicians, they kind of follow more comedic timings when it comes to doing the magic tricks. And you see that more and more with as stage magic has moved into the Penn and Teller style of like meta magic. Hey, we're showing you a magic trick, we're going to show you how the magic trick is done, but also we're doing another trick on you at the same time. So there's layers. Like, that's kind of where a lot of illusionism and misdirection has moved towards, or they go kind of like the Chris Angel man on the street. I'm going to do crazy ass stuff. It's, there's a lot going on with that, but there's an interesting point to be made there about how much more savvy audiences are, because they're completely saturated with media now. And you can actually have a Baudrillardian take on this, because one reason for the disconnect that we have with boomers is they're a product of modernism. And those of us on this call, I believe we're all millennials. We're the products of postmodernism. And so our media saturation sensitivity to it is quite different than the way boomers are, who tend to take things much more at face value. That's not a inherently bad thing. It's just, it's a completely different way that we experience reality. Yeah,
we always like do the meta analysis. Like we're always like critiquing the film itself, looking at like what it's trying to accomplish, that kind of thing. Like looking at the impact, what went into it. Like boomers don't do that. Boomers just immediately just perceive what's happening. Like, oh, that's just cool. Of a cool movie. Yeah, yeah, the magic guy in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you could wow audiences in the past by playing it straight, as their media and entertainment culture wasn't suffused with all this irony and meta awareness of presentation that we have now. And because the irony levels have descended to the point where now, like, people are trying to figure a way to ironically get past irony into a post irony thing. It's just layers upon layers that are basically descending into one another. We really are going into the desert of the real here.
Cue the David Foster Wallace.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was very frustrated with it, and he was trying to find a way out of that, but ultimately the only way he found out was through suicide.
Many such cases.
Yeah. And in terms of the film The Prestige, it leans a bit on telling you what its own conventions of storytelling are when it sets up that three-act structure through the pledge, the turn, the prestige. Part of it is to set up the various misdirections that they attempt throughout the film. But like I said, if you're smart enough, or you got a writer's mindset, or if you're just paying attention, you can quickly figure out what's going on. And like I said, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because fear of being predictable is what has led to the J.J. Abrams mystery box style storytelling, where there's nothing in the box. And I had Nick Mason on for the Mulholland Drive episode. He was correct to point this out, that you may not always get the answer you want, but inside the box or behind the door, there has to be something there, whether that's the mysteries or miracles of life, the sacraments and rituals of God or gods, or simple wonderment that just can't be defined, you know, the sublime. Even something simple is better than nothing, because you made the promise, you made that pledge, and that promise or pledge has to be kept. That's kind of one of the themes that's within this movie. You can't cheat the pledge.
Yeah, the typical Nolan plot, it usually involves some sort of a twist where at the end you find out that a character wasn't really who you thought that they were. Or, you know, they were sort of playing the, you know, there's a character who's either playing the audience or playing the other characters in the film the whole time. And this movie is no different. And I'm definitely like, I liked that about this movie. I like that about Christopher Nolan movies. A lot of people hate watching movies with me, especially women, because what I do when I watch movies like this is I'm just trying to figure out what's going on, and then what's going to happen next and how it's going to end. And then as soon as I do, I like blurt it out. But yeah, it definitely goes along that theme here. And I think if you're paying attention when you're watching the intro, you can see that the three acts that
Cutter.
Yes. Yeah.
Michael Caine's character. By the way, Michael Caine has completely been ruined for me, but because of Mike and Sven and their terrible impressions. I used to love Michael Caine. I'd watch anything he was in. I can't take him seriously anymore.
I can't do it. And especially, I think of Batman too. It's like that Batman is what ruined for me. It's like, now I'll watch this. I'm like, oh man. I see Nolan. I mean, what's his nuts? The Batman guy. Then I see Michael Caine. I'm like, oh geez, I'm watching a Batman movie.
Yeah, I started laughing as soon as I heard his voice when it came on for that reason. And it's really amazing how many Christopher Nolan movies he's in.
Oh,
he's been in basically all of them since he started Batman Begins. Like I believe he's kind of like the John Ratzenberger was to Pixar. That's what Michael Caine is to Christopher Nolan. Mm-hmm. I believe he's been in every movie since Batman Begins.
Or like what, you know, Samuel L. Jackson is to Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. Except less fetishized.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, speaking of just kind of finishing off, it's within the movie itself, you can take the same view the movie does, of that the secret impresses no one. The trick you use it for is everything, because Abrams and his style of storytelling, and like you see this in the George R. R. Martin Game of Thrones stuff as well, you know, they've been using media and storytelling as a way to trick people for bad reasons or for bad ends, and they don't give you anything for it. Storytelling has become extremely empty. They don't even give, because it's a lot of it's become so malicious and so anti-white and just anti-normalcy more than anything. Like, they don't know how to tell a story anymore, or they have no desire to tell a story anymore, a proper story. And so you're getting this malicious form of storytelling now. And that's, you know, like, if you're going to trick people, there has to be a reason for the trick. You don't trick just to trick them. It has to lead to some kind of revelation or epiphany, or you have to give them something. Like I said, the mystery box has to have something in it. It's not enough to entice people with the mystery box.
Yeah, I can think of a couple films, I think, to do a better job of, like, having a really good meta twist. Like Predator and From Dusk Till Dawn.
From Dusk Till Dawn's good.
Because both of those.
I like that one. I do like that one.
I like the way that they did a pretty interesting postmodern twist with both of those films, where they set you up thinking it's one thing, and then it swaps like halfway through. And you're like, oh wow, I'm in a totally different movie.
That one is done to great effect in From Dusk Till Dawn. I think because the film doesn't take itself seriously, that's why it works.
From Dusk Till Dawn does it better than Predator, only because after production they decided to add that stupid spaceship scene that was completely necessary. I know I ran about this on the last pause button we did about, like, you could have improved both of those films, like, was it Predator and the John Carpenter's movie that we were talking about?
The Thing.
Yeah, The Thing. I don't know what happened to my brain just now. I mean, Mike says it's here's The Thing every day. Maybe that's what happened to it. But anyway, just delete that spaceship scene, and both those films be massively improved.
Yeah, I guess if we're critiquing kind of filmmakers as well, I mean, within this film, working backwards is you mentioned this as well, Patrick, with the non-chronological order. And working backwards is a film trick that Nolan has done before. He did it like literally backwards with the movie Memento, but he does use it to interesting effect in this film. He tells you at the start how the three act structure of a supposed magic trick works, meaning that each trick is kind of a story at its own core. And so, like, in his movie, magicians are building and weaving a narrative through that succession of stories. And then he proceeds to do this in several scenes throughout the movie. You're presented with the pledge, the following scene is the turn, and it builds towards a little mini prestige as you're moving towards, like, trying to understand what's happening in this movie. So, for example, the way Angier presents how he and Borden met, you are led to think that they first met at a magic show as volunteers. Then the following scene turns this and shows you they were already accomplices at the time they knew each other. And you deliberately, and then of course you deliberately can't get a good look at Fallon in almost all the scenes he's in. Yep. So you know there's something going on here, but that's where, like, you know there's a trick that's being played on you. There's some kind of magic trick at the core of this. And so he's building towards a prestige now to what ultimate effect that does in the grand scheme of the movie. Cause like I said, this has kind of been a forgettable Nolan film. It was an interesting attempt at trying something different. It ultimately comes off cold in a number of, for a lot of the movie, and kind of my view on it, even though I did enjoy
this movie. That's how I feel that it was very difficult to invest in the characters. He doesn't really set up, like, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. Like, it's kind of ambiguous as far as that goes. I feel like Nolan kind of struggles to, like, create human characterizations. Like, he seems to be more intoxicated with how awesome his premise is. Like, oh wow, I've got this really cool idea, this concept, this twist, so I'm just going to kind of neglect the characters themselves. At least that's just how I feel about Nolan films.
Yeah, I think generally, but also applicable to this movie, is a lot of directors and filmmakers, they don't they don't flesh out characters' motivations well enough in terms of like why characters are doing the things that they're doing, why they're going on the journey or the quest that they want to go on. Definitely like drive is a big character and is a big factor in this movie in terms of the themes, like what's driving Christian Bale's character, what's driving Hugh Jackman's character to do what they want to do. And I was looking at an analysis of this. It was talking about the French psychoanalyst Lacan.
Yeah, I'm familiar with his works. I think I've made reference a couple times before. I'm kind of unimpressed personally.
Yeah,
what do you got on him?
I am too. I guess, you know, I just thought this was kind of an interesting thing to factor in. So just a little background on Lacan. He is a French psychoanalyst. He was maybe referred to himself or referred to by others as the most controversial psychoanalyst since Freud.
Oh, yeah.
In Freudian psychoanalysis, you have the id, which is like your sort of grug, like lizard brain desire to seek pleasure and do things. You have the ego, which is basically yourself. And then you have the superego, which is sort of like your morality, the voice in your head, the voice of your parents, like telling you what you should be doing, what the right thing to do is. And Lacan has the concepts of the ego ideal, the ideal ego, and the superego. So basically he breaks it up differently, where the ideal ego is the idealized self-image of the subject. So like the way that they would like to be, the way that they want others to see them. The ego ideal is the agency whose gaze has tried to impress upon others with the ego image. And then the big other or the big other or the super ego, you know, watches over the person and propels them to do their best. And basically in this film, you have these people sort of separated by these themes. Lacan basically says there's two things. There's people who are I lost my place here. There's people who are who have a drive and people who have want, basically. So people who have drive are they're driven to do something, to accomplish something. And then there's people also who are sort of like lacking and who want to fill this like sense of loss or sense of emptiness in themselves with something else. And you sort of see the characters in this movie shift.
Sure. Well, you're talking about women and men.
Yeah. So, I don't know, as I'm reading this, like I thought it was interesting, but it's not worth really going into too much because it gets very deep in this, but I think it does. It does explain, especially Angier's character. You know, there is this.
Well, we might end up touching on it anyways, because the thing is, there's within psychology and especially like past a certain kind of wellness point, a lot of psychologists got deep. I mean, like Jung, for example. I mean, like there's an esoteric, almost occult, and sometimes even occult aspects to a lot of psychology that occurs with a lot of when people get into these much more philosophical, higher minded ideas of how they're trying to conceptualize the human mind and the human identity and the human emotion. And so, I mean, it's we're going to be touching on this stuff in this episode anyways, but I did a bit of research into kind of like the Western esoteric tradition and these aspects. I mean, there is, and because this is about magic, this is about stage magic, there's always been an intersection between the two. I mean, when that quote I was reading when I opened this episode was from Arthur Machen, claimed British writer. That was from his probably his most popular story called The Inmost Light, or as it's now more well known, The Great God Pan. Like as we often say, and these things are related.
Yeah. And I think Christian Bale's character, Borden, in this is definitely, he is a guy who is sort of torn between, like, I guess I think as gay and bad as Freud is, it probably explains his character just as well, if not better, than Lacan's sort of take on, you know, the Freudian different different parts of you, different parts of your brain, which is like his super ego is telling him to be a good father, be a good husband. And, you know, his id or, you know, his drive, what really drives him is telling him to just be the best magician, to, you know, outsmart Angier. And he's definitely a very restless guy. He's sort of being torn between these two aspects of his personality, these two things that drive him. And there's one scene where he's like, you know, really like his wife, played by Rebecca, blanking on her last name. She was in The Town also. She looks at him and she's like, he'll tell her that he loves her. And she'll say like, oh, that was a real one today. Or like, that was like, yeah, you were sincere about that today. And it's because like, he does love her on some level, but he's also driven by this desire to win, to be the best magician. And he, a lot of times he'll let that sort of overshadow or overtake his role as to be a good father or a good husband. And he's not a particularly good father or good husband.
Yeah. That reminded me of Pulp Fiction, like that whole like scene there where she was talking about how she had the one that actually loved her today.
Yeah. Yeah. That was actually one of the best uses of the twist, I think, because like when you think about it in hindsight, it's like, oh, okay, now that all makes sense. That was one of the more clever uses of what they were doing with that. But on the topic of psychology, here's a hot take that just occurred to me. Let me throw this out so you guys see what you think. Freudian psychology is a deconstruction of the unconscious esoteric aspects of the Western soul. Jungian psychology is the reconstruction of it.
I like that.
Yeah, a little bit out there, but you know, like this is the pause button. We're a hot take factory.
Interesting. So all, you said all Jung...
five people understood that.
Well, because Freud is like part of the, is the cult. Freud is the culture of critique. He's the culture of critique. He's the Jewish critique of the Western soul. And there are unconscious, like within the Western soul, there are pagan aspects to it, no matter how Christian the continent became, because the Christianization was like what became the Western soul was a combination of a number of different factors. You had the pagan history, especially with the Greco-Roman tradition, and then you had the Christianization of that on top. And so and I'll get into this more when I talk about the esoteric aspects and these intersections, but there is this complex, nuanced, very deep aspect of the Western soul, which is also you know, psychology is downstream from soul, basically, like like a gestalt kind of thing. And so with Freudian psychology, you have the Jewish critique of that. Jung, who was a student of Freud, a lot of his psychology could be seen as a reaction in many ways because of an incorrect interpretation, and oftentimes a malicious interpretation that Freud had towards this. Now, Freud's psychology often fits the Jewish mindset better because he was a Jew, and so he's going to be able to talk from what he knows best. But there, you know, you can't avoid this racial aspect, especially when you look at civilization and its discontents, the way that Freud was very, very scared of what he saw within the collective masses of Europe. I mean, like, that's why I see like Jung's psychology as an attempt to reconstruct from that deconstruction and critique.
Yeah, Freud really sort of deconstructs everything and brings things down to a very sort of like base level interpretation of, you know, largely things are motivated by sex, repressed sexual desires, and negative things that happen during your childhood. So, you know, if you suffer some sort of trauma, or you don't get the sort of like fulfillment or love that you need when you're, say, like 3 years old, you can then be stuck in the oral stage of sexual development or whatever, which, you know, people have oral fixations, will be like more needy, things like that, compared to let's say you suffer some trauma when you're like 8 years old. Then Freud would say you're stuck now at the anal stage, which leads to things like OCD or hoarding or that sort of thing.
Anal retentiveness, which is where that term comes from.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting. I mean, you know, Freud, for as much as he's discredited, like a lot of the stuff in the DSM now, in like the DSM-5, soon to be DSM-6, is largely based on Freud. If you look at somebody with like obsessive compulsive personality disorder, for instance, it's completely based on Freud's anal retentive stage. So he, Freud reduced, like, that's a, I think that's a great way to put it, boys. So Freud reduces us to our most base level of understanding and set, and sort of plays into the whole idea of humans being like a blank slate, and they're affected by what happens in their childhood. And if they don't have a good childhood, that is going to shift the course of their whole life. Whereas Jung sort of pulls it back, brings in things like archetypes and synchronicity, and, you know, adds more of an aspect of spirituality and sort of connection to the other world or whatever in terms of synchronicity, but also connection to your ancestors, your history, your the land that you grew up on, certain figures of like the hero or the monster or things like that in terms of the archetypes. I really dislike Freud, and I do tend to like Jung a lot more, because as you said, you know, there's things that Freud hit on that are interesting and that can be broken down, but of course he interprets it and promotes it in a way that's very, very subversive.
Freud has a good insight into the neurotic, which it makes sense, yes, why that would be the case, but he has nothing insightful to say about the wine dark sea of the European soul. But go ahead, Alex.
I mean, Freud is the reason that Karl Popper started focusing on the idea of falsifiability, because Freud's methods didn't really pass that sniff test. It's like his hypothesis could be confirmed either way. Like, mm-hmm, there was, yeah, no way to show that he was actually wrong about anything, which also,
exactly,
was truly right about anything either.
And yeah, you can't disconnect Freud from like his essay, Civilization and Its Discontents, and the effect that it had on people like his double nephew, Edward Bernays, and the way that they ended up practicing out their psychology with the Central European, Central European psychoanalytic refugees. Like, when you cannot decouple these aspects from each other. So no matter what insightful critiques Freud may have had on neurotic personalities, it had nothing but most of his stuff was very unfalsifiable, and it led to a lot of very destructive forces within our society. And the fact that even psychologists largely just ignore many of the stuff he wrote is telling enough.
Yeah absolutely. And it's you know, I don't know if that would have been, this probably wouldn't have, Freudianism wouldn't have been in the zeitgeist at the time that this movie took place. Obviously not at the time it was made, but the time it took place in the late 19th century. But in terms of movies and ideas and books and things that came out in the early 20th century, the zeitgeist was rich with Freudianism, and that, like, those themes of childhood trauma and, you know, people trying to fulfill their desires based on a need to feel some lack or some trauma of the past to fix that is really laced in a lot of media. Even movies like Citizen Kane is very much sort of steeped in Freudianism. In terms of, like, just very, very basically, you have a kid who is separated from his parents when he's very young, and then the whole rest of the movie is sort of trying to fill that void of having lost his childhood, and he fills it with all these collections and personal possessions and big houses, and nothing ever makes him happy. Mm-hmm.
Funny aside, I have nothing to add to that, but no, it was just, since we were talking about storytelling, funny aside, I had never seen this movie, The Prestige, before, so, and I didn't know the twist in it, but as soon as I saw how the Tesla machine worked, I basically figured out the entire plot, which I don't know if that's probably not that impressive, but I had been watching this with a group of friends who wanted to surprise me with it, and they were annoyed when I basically described what I had figured out to them. It's just that, I guess, like, once you understand, like, the conventions of how things work, if you're like me, you'll try to reconstruct it in your own head. So the scene with the child is the clue to this whole movie.
Yes.
So the little kid who sees through the magic trick, because he's, yep, smart enough to spot the bird doubles are being killed, and his intelligence is being commented on. And that's a meta commentary on the audience that spots the initial twists and turns. But as anyone who's familiar with the occult stage or illusion can tell you, you do have to build layers into this to fool even the most astute if you want to tell a meaningful, surprising story.
Yeah, I mean, I think in retrospect, that one was really kind of like on the head, though. Like, I was telegraphing it like in boldface print. Like,
you weren't wrong to call Nolan the midwits thinking man, or the thinking man's midwit, or however you phrased it.
Yeah,
you weren't wrong.
A grown can watch a Nolan movie and feel smart when they
do. Well, it's like there is a Reddit, like I always remember like Nolan movies being very associated with Reddit and its the Reddit revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the Bugman race. Because like they've lost their sense of wonder. It's why I was making reference to the whole J.J. Abrams style of storytelling, because some of them are almost smart enough to grasp that it's not enough, but because they're so like they're swimming in this horrible environment, this horrible milieu that is Reddit, they're not able to truly take the extra step to become, you know, to find wonder in the world again. Like they start to like cargo cult, like what it means, like the idea of like car, like, you know, the cargo culting the experience. I want to have an experience, like I want something to feel real, because nothing feels real to them anymore, because they've lost the genuine amazement and wonderment at the world, and they end up fetishizing. It's like much like how somebody who's not in a relationship or has no experience with women, they want the experience of a woman, and then they see pornography or something, some kind of other media image, and so they fetishize or commodify that media or visual experience, and so they don't actually know what it's truly like or genuinely what it's like to be with a woman, and so they don't understand like. Well, image and reality are not the same thing, and one is the image is often a very, very distorted or false form of the reality.
Yeah, and in terms of Reddit, I mean, we've seen movies get worse and worse over the last 10 years, especially the last like 5 or 6 years, and the enthusiasm on Reddit has seemingly stayed the same, and I think in large part that is because, yeah, like you said, these people have lost their sense of wonder, and also they have nothing else, right? So they're going to sort of overemphasize the power or the, you know, the experience that they had watching some Marvel movie or even a Christopher Nolan movie, and probably give it more credit than it's due, not to mention the sort of consensus building aspect of Reddit, which is especially nefarious given the amount of like total censorship and astroturfing on that website. So people will like, I've even talked to friends of mine who have said things like this, where they like they've gone to see a movie and they didn't like it, and then they're like reading all the reviews or like reading something on Reddit, and they're like, actually maybe that movie was kind of good, you know, actually maybe I did kind of like that movie.
Reddit encapsulates what Guy Debord called the society of the spectacle. Like they are spectators, they are people who are can only understand things as the spectacle, it can only consume the spectacle, which is why like you have like these Netflix shows and Amazon shows like Hunters and Game of Thrones and Marvel movies and all that, they're chasing an experience, like that's they're chasing an experience, and so it transforms into that spectacle, but there's no content in there, there's nothing that you can take away from that. Like what meaning am I supposed to drive from that awesome time that Captain America punched out the guy that's really bad because he said something mean about diversity or something?
Yeah, it's very hard to find anything that gives you that sense of wonder. I think the last film I could remember that did that, I was watching Mandy, and like the use of color and the creative like artistic strokes of the cinematography and that I was like, wow,
movie's a trip.
Yeah, this is a gorgeous, gorgeous film. And it was easy to get lost in that, just get sucked into it.
Yeah, I definitely, I would go as far as to say I do get a sense of wonder on some level from Nolan's films. Unfortunately, I'm one of those people who really, when I watch a movie, I really am looking to make sure like the plot makes sense and adds up, which is a failing on Nolan's part, especially in movies like, you know, Batman 3, the Dark Knight Rises, Inception, Interstellar. Like you can sort of piece together that the plot works and there's not like big plot holes in the movie. Like you can sort of do some cognitive dissonance to override that, but there are, and it definitely takes away, it takes away from the wonder aspect, but I will give him credit for at least like doing, something that requires some level of thinking and sort of thinking outside the box.
People like his movies because he actually cares about the cinematography, and because media has gotten so lazy in every form of storytelling that it's supposed to employ, and they take the easiest option, or you just have people who got into the business through nepotism and the like, or and like they really have nothing to say and don't know how to say it. Yeah, you get the stuff, like people forget, like they see a Nolan film, it's like, oh wow, you can actually tell, you can really do interesting things with visual storytelling. Like, and this is like the, this is like, you know, baby's first entry into visual storytelling can actually be an interesting medium.
Yep.
What were you gonna say, Alex?
He mentioned Interstellar, and I cannot stand that film. That is the most pretentious pile of garbage. tolerate that movie. Somebody in the editing department should have just attacked it with machete. Then it would have been halfway decent.
You know, I think every time you're on, I think every time you're on this show, Alex, you always say somebody should have taken the machete to this film.
Yeah, well, I mean, Interstellar, it's like what, 17 hours?
Yeah, definitely too long. I did like Interstellar, and I think partly for that reason is just there's so many bad movies out now that if you get one that has like an interesting idea, it stands out. But yeah, I agree to the extent that it was too long and that there were plot holes and it was very full of itself. I didn't hate it though.
It was insanely self-absorbed. And to be honest, The Prestige is somewhat guilty of that as well. Like, I think it's just like one of Nolan's like characteristics in general.
Yeah. Well, I think we've talked enough about that. Do you guys want to talk about the Industrial Revolution and its consequences?
Yes. Absolutely.
So I know you had some stuff on this Apache. I think I'll preface this a little bit because I did say I wrote down notes of what the different industrial revolutions were, and this will help kind of prefigure this conversation. So this movie gives us a glimpse of an interesting transitional period in American and British history, because thanks to a lot of Kaczynski memeing, there's a lot of us that have the Industrial Revolution in our minds, but that's actually kind of a bit of an oversimplification, because there's actually been three industrial revolutions in the span of about 250 years or so, to really drive home how much things have changed in such a short span of time. So the first, and I'll explain what all these are quickly. The first industrial revolution was the transition to factories and machines and the production of items. That's usually what people think of, like, oh, the factory has now here, like now we are industrialized. The second industrial revolution was the technological revolution, and that gave us things like electricity and new forms of transportation. And you get, this is like the building the railroads and all that. This, and all that fundamentally changed how we engage with our lifestyles and mobility. And the third industrial revolution was the digital revolution, where we moved away from analog technology to digital technology. Now, there's been talk of entering the fourth industrial revolution, and how they're going to manage it, and when does it occur, with the current talk that's been going on for many years of cybernetics, robotics, 5G wireless technology, all those advancements, and especially biotech, I think, being emblematic of all that. And so the way I kind of define all this is that each of these revolutions can be simplified to a theme of how it's changed humanity. The first changed the production of things. The second changed the mobility of things. The third changed the knowledge of things. And the fourth will likely change the actual being of things, which is another theme that's been present in many of Baudrillard's writings when he talks about the different orders of simulacrum. Mm-hmm. You were going to say, Alex?
No, I was just nodding along with you. Continue.
So into this movie, we come into an America and England that are in the midst of the second industrial revolution. You got, as the backdrop, the rivalry between Tesla and Edison and the different companies they represented. And this is when humanity began to enter these new stages. And you had people with living memories of how things used to be and living through those changes. And in fact, the main characters actually represent much of that clash and the cost of those changes. Angier represents the incredible pledge, but the terrible cost of the turn to get the prestige that comes with the new technology. And Borden represents the dedication to the craft of a pre-industrial world, which is much harder to pull off and involves much more work without that technological cheat. But it's something realer, something more down to nature, something that is just more natural. And so at this point, if you've listened this far, you know what happens in the movie. Angier himself actually becomes a Baudrillardian character. He's a simulacrum. By the end of the movie, he's a simulacrum. He's a copy of a copy of a copy of the original long lost. Angier, he is the desert of the real. And yeah, it's just like it occurred to me, I was watching, like, oh my God, like it's like it's just simulacrums all the way down.
Yeah, you've got that great moment with David Bowie's character talking about the cost of your obsessions.
Yep. Yeah, that was the best. That was the best quote in the movie, I thought. He said, David Bowie's Tesla character looks at Angier and says, "I can recognize an obsession. No good will come of it." And Angier says, "Hasn't good come of your obsessions?" And Tesla replies, "At first, but I've followed them too long. I am their slave, and one day they'll choose to destroy me." And that's sort of what I was talking about before in terms of people's motivations. I think in terms of the Industrial Revolution, because I just have sort of a quick thing to say, and then you can get back into it, Borzoi. You know, the one of the things that this movie shows is just the how far reaching, you know, these industrial revolutions are. Like when people write about the Industrial Revolution, probably one thing that they don't talk about is like, oh, it changed magic forever, you know, with the introduction of technology. But it just shows how these changes are so sweeping and so like paradigm shifting that they really reach out and touch pretty much everything. I think also you do have some of the I picked up on some like sort of metaphors for the Industrial Revolution, especially the second Industrial Revolution in terms of like manufacturing and industry and stuff like that. One of the things was how Borden's character gets his fingers shot off by Angier, much like you know, people working in a factory during that time would lose limbs. You know, his fingers were shot off by a gun because he did this trick where someone shoots a gun that doesn't have a bullet in it, and then the magician pretends to catch the bullet. But Angier wanting to get back at him for supposedly killing his wife by tying the wrong knot when she did a magic trick where she's has to escape from a tank filled with water. Angier puts the actual bullet in the gun and shoots Borden's fingers off, which is, you know, again, similar to the way people lose fingers or limbs there. But there's also sort of it's really important to also think about like who has control over the technology. Like I think about this a lot now, right, with AI and stuff like that. Like Kaczynski, this stuff is bad. It's what do you say?
Kaczynski talks about this.
Yeah, like AI is, it's a scary enough premise and future to begin with, and then once you think about the people that are in control of it, it makes it all the more scary. And also just in terms of like, you know, you have these guys sort of using technology not for good, but for to propel themselves to stardom and fame and to fulfill their sort of own desires or inadequacies that they want to fix. And then also with Tesla, you have the whole aspect of like, here he creates this amazing machine for Angier, which is like basically a teleporting machine or a cloning machine, actually, not a teleporting machine.
Well, that's what a teleport machine is. Like, this is I had this as a minor note, but that's one of the problems with science fiction. Like, people have always dreamt of like, when are we gonna have teleporters? Well, as we as teleportation would need to work, unless they can find a different way of dealing with actual physics, with the physics as we understand them, like to use a teleporter is to kill yourself. It is literally to kill yourself because you have to be broken down and reassembled in some way. So there's a lot of philosophical.
Yeah.
People make philosophical treatises like, well, is that person who emerges over there, is that actually you, or is that a new consciousness? Like, when you lose consciousness, when you are broken down through the teleportation, like, is that version of you fundamentally dead, or do you remember like being yourself before the teleportation happened, when you're reconstituted on the other side? This is a problem that comes up in science fiction.
There's a great episode of Outer Limits. The reboot of Outer Limits in the 1990s handles this with an episode called "Think Like a Dinosaur." It digs into like the duplication via teleportation and what you do with the redundant copy and all of that. It's worth watching if you've never seen it.
This is one of the reasons why Bones from the original Star Trek series was, I can't remember if that's explicitly why, but it's one of the reasons why, that's been expanded upon, like why he did not want to use the teleporter, is that it is effectively a form of murder or suicide, whatever's happening with it. Like, that version of you that goes into the teleporter machine, that dies. Now, how does this function? Like, when you are reconstituted, do you have those previous memories? Whatever it is, like, that's a different iteration of you. That's a completely different person. That's literally, that's a different guy.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of like Tesla, we have this you know, brilliant scientist who was you know, in many ways sort of stopped in his tracks or prevented from achieving his full potential by Edison and by, you know, other sort of powers at that time. In addition to that, he creates this this cloning machine, and it's, what is it used for? It's used for magic, because that's who wants it, that's who will pay for it, essentially. So it also reflects the way, like, we have, like, we talk about jogger tech, right? How we have all this advanced technology, but it's not really used to make people's lives better. It's used to keep us, like, you know, pleasure seeking and comfortable and distracted, and ultimately making us lazier and you know, hurting our wrists and our posture and our necks and everything like that. And just also just in terms of the sort of competition between Bale and Jackman's characters in this, like, they are not really. It could even sort of mirror the competition between, you know, big magnates at that time, and sort of how they stomped over people to beat the other guy to really the benefit of nobody except themselves, which I think is definitely sort of reflected in both characters to an extent.
Yeah, it's funny that, go ahead, Alex.
I was going to say that the interesting thing is, if you look at the Industrial Revolution, that's whenever your birth rates actually started collapsing.
Yep.
If you look at the overlap between Industrial Revolution and then suddenly cratering of birth rates, it centers around that expansion of industrial capitalism. And that's really probably the best way to explain what happened with that particular phenomenon.
Yeah. And it's, I'm really glad, Patrick, that you keyed in on the effect that technology has on magic, because magic, whether it be in the occult esoteric form or the illusionist stage form, because the two have often overlapped because of the misdirection and sleight of hand aspects that can be used in ritual. And I have a whole history on that that I'll get into a little bit later in this. But
Clark's first law, is that right?
What?
Clark's first law, like,
well, that's literally what I was about to get into, Alex. This is exactly where I was going with this, because you can see concurrent with the themes of artist and the obsession, concurrent with the themes of artist and art and the obsession with craft, because what separates art from commodity is often a very thin line, and it's one that's disappearing more and more by the day. And with this movie being about magic, it really does bring to mind Clark's law. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And the obsession goes into that, because this idea of control, like, how do you control technology, like, or does technology end up controlling you? Does it end up shaping you? Which was what Jacques Ellul, like, that was his argument in the technological societies, that man does not shape technology. Technology shapes man, because eventually what you do is you have to because of what technology requires and what the technological society would require. You have to restructure everything around that technology. I always use the example of roads. Like, in order to have roads, like, you have to restructure how people walk and go about. Like, things have to now be planned out in this way, and human beings have to now be restricted in their movement so they don't get hit by automobiles. And now you need technology to manage all this aspect of moving machines. And so man is shaped in his habits and behavior by that. And as the technology becomes more and more complex and more and more unable for the average man is even more divorced from how that technology actually works and functions, it becomes a kind of magic to him, and also has this effect on him where it can change his biology. You mentioned fertility rates, Alex. That's one. We've seen posture change. Like, we've seen the way that people are, like, their health is deteriorating the more technological they have become. And then they seek more technological solutions to try and fix those problems. God only knows what that does to the human body.
Yeah.
Yeah, because then you're locked into that paradigm, and the only way to get out of it is to continue innovating. I don't know. We could go down the entire graph Twitter rabbit hole on that superstitious belief that the only way out is more innovation.
Yeah.
No, wrong.
The cult of progress. That's what John Michael Greer called it, the cult of progress.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things with technology or even basic planning, like, this isn't a perfect example, but you know, Borzoi, you gave the example of roads, and I was just thinking about how in America now there's a lot of places that are trying to introduce bike lanes into cities and roads and stuff like that, and it's a total shit show because people don't really know how to. I'm sorry, I'm probably going to trigger Alex right now, but it's a total shit show because people don't know how to like drive and share the road with bikes. You go to a place like Amsterdam, you go to a country like the Netherlands where most people bike. It's a relatively small country. They've been doing this for decades. They have a whole system worked out with the place on the road for the cars, the place for the tram, and the bike lane. And it takes sort of years for people to adjust to this. And with when they try to do this stuff in America, it never works out because there's a, and that's not like a great example of technology, but it's sort of just a change in the way things are and how it takes people a while to adapt to them. So just like with any technological advancement, the adaptation is usually much later in the future, and oftentimes like the necessary adaptation ends up harming people. You know, like people, it's hard to make a case that people are better off now because of the internet and things like that. Like there are obviously great advantages to it, but additionally it's just caused so many problems for people.
And that's the theme of it, because the Tesla's machine has a benefit for Angier. It allows him to perform the greatest trick of all time, the trick that nobody can figure out the way that it actually works. And like, but what is the cost of that turn? Well, it's literally a human life. It's a human life that has to be deposited, stowed away. Like, it has to be constantly hidden. Like, he has literally skeleton, water chests of skeletons in his closet. Basically, it's that's the cost of this technological solution. To be able to put out the greatest prestige that man has ever seen, it's literally causing bodies to stack up. And I guess, like, on this theme as well, between that tension between the of this changing world we've been going through, because like this is in the time that this set is right after the Romantic period. The 19th century was the period of Romanticism, where because you had this industrialization going on and you had these decline in monarchies and this rise of liberalism, people were taking like a turn towards a much more, like, they were looking backwards with some nostalgia. I mean, and some of this was prefigured by people like Sir Walter Scott, who wrote the first historical fiction novel. People were looking back to try to reconstruct the past in their own way, in a way, because they were so alien to what they were seeing. Dan Schumann of Creative Screenwriting, he said that the prestige asks how far one would go to devote oneself to an art, which becomes a very pressing question once technology is able to replicate art as well. And the character of Chung Ling Su, according to Schumann, is a metaphor for this theme. And film critic Alex Manoogian, he refers to this theme as the meaning of commitment. Nicholas Rapold of Film Comment addressed those points that they raised, and he puts this in terms of the film has a refracted take on romanticism. So ultimately what I mean by all this is that Angier's technological solution, which suggests art as sacrifice and a phoenix-like death of the self, and Borden's more meat and potatoes form of stagecraft embody the divine between the artist and the social being, especially in a technological society.
Yeah, because Borden is living the act. Like, his entire existence is wrapped up in this. And then,
to the point that nobody knows he had an identical twin,
right? And then Angier, of course, takes the technological shortcut, which has the cost of his soul, basically.
Yeah, and 6 million bodies, basically.
Yeah.
I guess quickly, I did have some notes on Tesla as well, because the funny thing is that this movie was the first to really bring Nikola Tesla back into the public consciousness.
I was wondering about that, because
it was a 2006 movie. Because the Reddit effect.
Tesla's the Reddit.
Where Tesla became Reddit and Tesla became meme was because of Matt Inman, who was the artist behind the comic The Oatmeal, which was just Reddit moment after Reddit moment as a comic. And he's the one who really fueled this whole Tesla as a god and I almost said Michael Edison. Thomas Edison was a douchebag. And he, like, Matt Inman is almost solely responsible for all of that, because yes, there was a rivalry between Tesla and Edison, and that was more between Westinghouse, which had used Tesla's AC current versus Edison's direct current. Now, I'm not good with science, so there's not much I can really say about that, but I'll just read my note on this. So one thing this movie ended up prefiguring was the Tesla meme that would be spammed endlessly in the early teens decade, whatever that decade was called. And a lot of that, like I said, was largely thanks to Matt Inman, which is about as close to Reddit manifest as any man could be. He had written a very juvenile comic that was praising Tesla and trashing Edison, but he especially fueled a lot of really bad memes about Tesla. And now, to Matt Inman's credit, and I have to give credit where credit's due, he was involved in preserving the Tesla Science Center at Wardenclyffe. So I got to give him that. I mean, like he at least was genuine about that kind of stuff. And I am not an expert on this subject personally, so I'm not going to go into all the autistic detail, but basically the way I looked into it myself, the way it kind of really boils down is Tesla was a brilliant but eccentric and weird man who was very, people have often found difficult to deal with, who tended to exaggerate things that he was doing and overpromise what he was doing. Like, he had a tendency to take people's money and not work on what he was supposed to be working on, like, which is actually kind of depicted in this movie. And Edison, by contrast, he was also a brilliant man, but he was a shrewd businessman more than anything, and he treated the world as such. So when you read stories that try and get into personal details and conflict between the men, they try to slander one or the other, you're kind of, like, people are generally missing the point, because like what's really the big thing is like the age these men helped create and helped prefigure how ruthless it really prefigured how ruthless a technological liberal capitalist age would become, because they represent all the different aspects of it. You have the fetishization of science and technology with Tesla, and you have the horrible capitalistic practices of Edison. They both but they also, in their own way, they were brilliant men. They were both extremely brilliant men who did a lot to advance the world, but like that's like they are emblematic of what the technological society is.
Yeah, and Nolan's casting of Bowie as Tesla in this movie definitely plays into the sort of, you know, Tesla Reddit cult. I think I'm actually looking at a quote right now from Nolan where he says, Tesla was this otherworldly, ahead of his time figure, and at some point it occurred to me that he was the original man who fell to Earth. As someone who was once the biggest Bowie fan in the world, once I made that connection, he seemed the only actor capable of playing the part.
Yeah, I saw the esoteric and the occult in that casting, but that makes more sense when I hear Nolan put it that way.
That's an interesting take, because I had that conversation last night with my wife. I was like, I remember Tesla becoming a meme again, and I couldn't remember like what era exactly this happened. Like, I know it was somewhere vaguely between 2005 and 2015.
Yep, about 2011, 2012. Yep,
2011. That's what.
Which when the Oatmeal did that comic, and that's where it exploded. Yeah, that came. I remember living through that.
If even thinking to today, like Elon Musk, right? His company is called Tesla. He presents himself sort of as a modern Tesla, the man who can do these things previously thought impossible, and is advancing science, but also like helping the world through, not needing fossil fuels for cars and all these other sort of
giving your baby stupid names.
Yeah.
I got nothing else on the technological aspects of this. Is there anything else you guys wanted to touch on that?
No, let's move along.
Okay. So, all right.
Nope, I'm giving that too.
Magic and the occult. So magic obviously plays magic is the prominent role of this movie. When there was one thing I wanted to take a look at, but I never was able to get a copy of it. I want to get a copy of Tarbell's book on it, which is the most comprehensive set of magic, and most of the basic magic that is depicted in this book lays out many of the basic methods and tricks and that are laid out, and then, like, you see this in the movie as well. It's laid out in Tarbell's Course in Magic. It's probably actually the most notable encyclopedia for magicians after Hoffman's Modern Magic. And actually, in a funny twist of fate, because as magic moved away from the occult and ritualistic roots to becoming more and more just stage performance, and it got compiled into this book, it actually began to influence the medicine men of the less developed world. Like, African medicine men have allegedly ordered this book and had it delivered to them in brown paper bags to disguise their craft and keep their followers unaware of the misdirection and sleight of hands they're using when they're doing their medicine man shamanistic rituals in places like Africa and, you know, other places I don't give a crap about. They're essentially cribbing from stage magic, which has been building on these centuries of traditions. At least this is according to Douglas Hunt in The Art of Magic. Now, this movie doesn't get into the esoteric as much. That's one of the reasons why I kind of consider this a little bit of a cold movie. It only brushes up against the edges of it with its themes of the living act, the near ritual aspects that magic has, and the tension with science and the technological revolution with men like Nikola Tesla. But this is worth talking about. That's why I'm glad we mentioned the whole David Bowie aspect, because I originally thought this was a deliberate nod at those things. So I'm quoting from this Medium post that was entitled "The Magic and Mystery of David Bowie," which is what I found very interesting. It's on his 1971 album, Hunky Dory. Bowie's fascination with magic becomes less opaque as he makes references to things fairly well known by other seekers in the early 70s. Crowley gets his necessary nod on Quicksand, a downbeat song about a spiritual crisis. Bowie's biographer, Nicholas Pegg, makes particular note of the song "Oh, You Pretty Things," with its warning that Homo sapiens have outgrown their use. Pegg believes this is a nod to the writing of Edward Bulwer Lytton. In his 1871 novel, The Coming Race, a man finds an entrance to the Hollow Earth, where he discovers an ancient super people described as a race akin to man's, but infinitely stronger of form and grandeur of aspect, who use an energy called Vril to perform wondrous feats such as controlling everything from the weather to emotions. This delightfully strange story might have gone the way of other quaint 19th century fantasies, but for Morning of the Magicians by Louis Powell and Jacques Bergier, first published in France in 1960 and translated into English in 1963, which created a wave of esoteric speculation and occult conspiracy theories still being felt today. The authors were inspired by the writer Charles Hoyt, who in the first decades of the 20th century used an inheritance to spend his time in the New York Public Library collecting stories and data from a wide range of sources, all of which suggest an underlying and connected web of paranormal and supernatural phenomena. Using Fort's method, Powell and Bergier outlined a secret history in which important historical figures intuited their own role in shaping a cosmic destiny for mankind. Aliens had visited mankind during the first days of Western civilization, and where alchemy and modern physics were not in opposition. The 70s also needed a messenger who could personify astronomical dreams and occult permutations, a figure of decadence and wisdom who could deliver a rock and roll testament to what it's like to fall between the worlds. Only Bowie could imagine such a creature.
Yeah, I think I don't think the two reasons for having Bowie in the movie are mutually exclusive. And just as is the theme with this movie, like, you know, there's the sort of misdirection. Who knows? Nolan could have been misdirecting the audience with that quote about Bowie. Both explanations True. Make sense. And that's sort of the whole theme of the movie. It's like you're sort of looking, or the intention is you're sort of like looking in one direction, and then in the background something else happens. That's the true thing going on.
By the way, The Morning of the Magicians, it cannot be understated how influential that book was. That's where we get a lot of the Nazi occultism comes from. It comes from The Morning of the Magicians. Like, it's, you cannot understate, like, that's where like a lot of the Nazi UFO stuff comes from as well, where they're talking, and like the Vril stuff, like all that stuff came back into the popular imagination, or was invented for the popular imagination with that book. It got into crypto history, ufology, alchemy, spiritual philosophy. It's probably one of the most influential books of the 20th century.
Yeah, I have this book called The Occult and the Third Reich by Jean-Michel Engbert, and that book is mentioned multiple times in this book or quoted.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, when I was doing this episode, I had a mind. Why am I talking about all this? Well, I'm going to build to it. There's my pledge to you all. So when I was doing this episode, I went to kind of look more into Arthur Machen and the Western esoteric tradition, because Machen's kind of associated with that. Now, Arthur Machen, again, a horror writer, basically, is what he's most well known for. He was very influential. Arthur Machen remained a high church Anglican his entire life. And he was actually one of only five writers who supported Franco and the Nationalists in a writer's poll on the Spanish Civil War. But he was interested in the esoteric and in paganism, despite being this high church Anglican. And so a story of the great god Pan, which was originally known as The Inmost Light, is considered one of the greatest and most influential horror stories in the English language. It even influenced H.P. Lovecraft. Many of Machen's stories depict people's inductions into the esoteric, pagan, or magical mysteries. And there's so much that can be talked about with the great god Pan that actually just deserves its own episode. But it's a story about, now stop me if you've heard this before, it's a story about a woman being involved in an experiment that allows her to see the supernatural world. And so that's why I kind of keyed in on Machen, because he serves as this great point of intersection in discussing these various points of the whole Western tradition, as it were, the esoteric Western tradition. Because despite being a high church Anglican his whole life, even being interested in Catholicism at one point, but never committing to that, he also felt himself drawn to the pagan and esoteric world. And he's kind of what I would consider a pagan Christian. And that's a tradition that has seen itself play itself out in the margins of the West time and time again. I was actually listening to the Great Choruses once last year on the history of England. And the lecturer has a story about the Christianization of the British Isles, where a local ruler had found himself quite taken in by the Christian faith and he wanted to convert, but his wife threw a fit about it and he didn't want to quarrel with her. So he simply added the Christian God as a notch to his pagan worship and worship God privately along with the other idols. And so how Christianity has dealt with this syncretism that's ebbed and flowed and changed throughout history in its approach and policies. And it's for that reason that pagan Christians have recurred and reoccurred with folk magic traditions having been retained in some form or another and evolving from out of that into other things. And so those who have been interested in the Western esoteric have often found no shortage of material for themselves to return to. And you can get to really deep into that. And so with the transformation by the esoteric, and this is what's similar to stage magic attempts to give you a simulation of, this Machen writes from the great god Pan, "You see the mountain and hill following after hill. As wave on wave, you see the woods and orchard, the fields of ripe corn and the meadows reaching to the reed beds by the river. You see me standing here beside you and hear my voice. But I tell you that all these things, yes, from that star that has shone out in the sky to the solid ground beneath our feet, I say that all these are but dreams and shadows, the shadows that hide the real world from our eyes. There is a real world, but it is beyond this glamour and this vision, beyond these chases and eras, dreams in a career, beyond them all as beyond a veil. I do not know whether any human being has ever lifted that veil, but I do know, Clark, that you and I shall see it lifted this very night from before another's eyes. You may think this all strange nonsense. It may be strange, but it is true, and the ancients knew what lifting the veil means. They called it seeing the god Pan." Now, he's talking about the god Pan in this, that's kind of a metaphor for the mysteries of life. At least that's the way I interpret it. And that's why I've been striking on these themes throughout the entire episode, is that you can't, if you get interested in stage magic, unless you're just doing this for the entertainment value of I want to see a neat trick and I don't want to know how the trick is performed, because then the magic is gone. That itself is just a metaphor. We want there to be something to this world. That's what I mean by the mystery box. There has to be something to it. It doesn't matter how it actually functions. It just has to signify there is something there. That's the mystery of life. And people can get deep into this, into the esoteric, trying to uncover what that means. But once you learn what the trick is, it's not as interesting as it once was. That is an interesting paradox within magic, whether that's stage magic or whether that's the occult.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, just in terms of the occult, many people's fascination with it is just because it's this sort of unknown, maybe dangerous or forbidden thing. And, it just reflects in that scene when Borden is telling his wife the catching the bullet trick, and she says, "Oh, well, now that you explain it to me, it seems so obvious." And he the whole movie he's saying once somebody knows the trick, it totally takes all the mystery, well, obviously the mystery, but all the enjoyment out of it. It's never, it just becomes it's not novel anymore. It just becomes very accepted.
Yeah, and the trick isn't the issue. It's why the trick? What is the trick being used for? And that's actually why mystery is an aspect of the Christian religion, and that's why there is this and these things that overlap with that. I mean, in the Orthodox faith, the sacraments are referred to as the mysteries. They are the mysteries, and the why, like the how of it, doesn't matter. You're not meant to know what the how of it is. It's that you're meant, like the ritual is meant to, it offers you the promise of everlasting life, and that mystery in and of itself is meant to give you that sense of wonder and transcendence of being in that relation of giving yourself over to God. Like that's how to interpret that within that religion. But like these elements are present in any kind of tradition that has something meaningful to say or something meaningful to show you ostensibly, whether that's the case or not. So, I mean, like stage magic, sleight of hand, misdirection. I mean, Roger P. Taylor in The Death and Resurrection Show, he describes the shaman's test as to be in the company of spirits does not make a shaman. It is what the shaman can do as a result, which counts. So remember now the theme of this film, the secret impresses no one. The trick you use it for is everything. I mean, Harry Houdini himself said it's not the trick, it's the magician. So throughout history, you have this dual role of the magician as minstrel and back alley soothsayer. And it's not for nothing that these people often travel with the sort of acting entertainers that were denied Christian burials. These aspects also predate the Christian ascendancy. I mean, Seneca the Younger was already bored by some of the most basic magician tricks. And then, but this whole thing continues on until later in the Middle Ages. You got sleight of hand performances being outlawed in medieval French towns. So where the intersection occurs is that theatrical illusion was employed in passion plays and liturgical dramas in order to depict the levitation and illumination of angelic and heavenly figures. And then you have an even deeper concern about magic and witchcraft that grew in the 16th century, which interestingly, after the invention of the printing press, again, like we see the effect that technology has on magic. Like, there was always this concern with magic and witchcraft, but the concern for it grew even more years after the printing press was invented. So we see this interesting contradiction that occurs, is that the more technological people become, the more the stronger many superstitions become. Like, people don't actually become more scientific because of the strange effect that technology has on us. I'm kind of rambling. I don't know if you guys want to jump in at this point.
You're basically talking about like sort of intersection between the whorehouse and like the occult practices. And I noticed that in this film, like it's quite literal where they show some of these women that are basically like stagehands and helpers and such. And it's like these are basically like prostitutes.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what actors often doubled as were prostitutes. Actresses, especially.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, on the topic somewhat of the Out of Shadows pause button that you guys did last week, like that's basically what Hollywood is like a whorehouse to promote the occult. Yeah. There's all the you've got all these young actresses and oftentimes children who are like abused and raped by Hollywood Jews, and then you have the obviously the whole Harvey Weinstein thing and the way these women sort of in a way like sell their bodies to be part of show business. They sleep with the people in power to get where they are, and then they are used to sort of they get this fame, but it also comes with this emptiness, and the fame that they get is acquired through sort of being a medium or like a stand-in to just promote oftentimes sort of like a cult or subversive beliefs to the public.
Mm-hmm. The deepest concern about magic and witchcraft actually was probably occurred in the, I mean, like until recently anyways, happened in the 16th century, which was after the invention of the printing press. And it was also interestingly kind of concurrent with how Protestantism was now deeply established in Northern Europe. In 1584, J. Prevost's book Clever and Pleasant Inventions was published, and in it he warns, "I've seen over many years now in all the best cities of our good France the simple and rustic commoner utterly charmed and bewitched by the heap of charlatans that do overrun our country. These magicians couch in words of outlandish gibberish. They deem themselves superintendents not only of Lucifer, Astaroth, Beelzebub, and their servants, but also of the legions of hell, with absolute power and masterful authority, having found a most favorable subject for all their shocking offenses, which is ignorance, the mother of error."
So I echoes of many things I'm hearing in there, but
that, oh yeah,
the same year that book was published, the British gentleman Reginald Scott published Discovery of Witchcraft, and then 13 years later the future King James I wrote Demonology, which was one of the most important texts in the burgeoning field of demonology and a Christian analysis of the supernatural. It's auspicious that the translation of the King James version of the Bible coming into this milieu was that you have that famous line from Exodus 22:18, which was translated as "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." Now, how "witch" should be translated comes down to how the Hebrew word "mekshesheppa" should be translated, and there's many ways for this to be approached. But conjuration was certainly on European minds at this time as they tried to get a more complete understanding of the natural creation and the supernatural's place within it, especially as now they're like. Information was like their way of understanding the world was becoming fundamentally changed by now the fact that more and more of the society was becoming literate, more and more of the society was beginning to become like there was more and more connections being established, and you had this coming off of the Enlightenment and the Protestant Reformation and all this. So this is a Europe that's undergoing a crucible of change, and people were now living through a time period where they were trying to understand. Like actually, the French historian or French philosopher Lucien Favre, I believe his name was. He did a whole thing about religious belief in 16th century France. And he concluded, because he looked at how people lived their day-to-day lives. He looked at everything that was written during that time, literally everything. And what he concluded from that is that it was basically impossible to be an atheist in that time period, because your experience and the way you experience reality was so suffused with religious expression, religious talk, and religious experience that it was just simply impossible. Like, there was God, there was devil, there was evil, there was good, but it was just simply not possible to not think about the supernatural in some way during that time period. And so that's, you have people like an obsession with witchcraft and magic and the like, because this is how they were, this is the experience that was being transmitted to them through the little media that they did have, but from the cultural experience and the religious experiences they were constantly having during this time period.
Yeah, and you know, just like a magic trick, I think it's worth bringing this up. Just like a magic trick, with the advent of the printing press and mass publication, and people being able to now have lots of information at their fingertips that they wouldn't have had before, and then followed by the increase in literacy and things like that. There's always a desire for this sort of like esoteric knowledge, or to have some level of what's really going on. Who's really calling the shots? What are people up to? And you know, it's no coincidence that, you know, shortly after this, you have groups like the Freemasons form and things like that, where the
ritual ritual misdirection, a huge aspect of
that. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what magic is, right? Ritual misdirection to an extent. I mean, you know, magic with a K, I guess, is ritual, and then magic with just a C is misdirection. And so with the advent of all this information, that is now you have the necessary advent of misdirection and getting people focused, like, you know, just even stuff like what you guys were talking about on TDS with like Satanism, and how largely it's like a misdirection from, you know, child abuse and ritualistic child abuse. That's
just Judaism, just straight up Judaism.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's just a misdirection from Judaism. It's just not even necessarily Judaism. Just the tendencies of Jewish persons.
Yeah.
Collectively.
Yeah. It's just an extracurricular course in Judaism. But I mean, like, I guess kind of capping this specific discussion right here. I mean, a commonly believed origin of the words hocus pocus, you know, there we go. Like magic words right there. Hocus pocus. This is not proven. This is unproven. But a commonly believed origin is that it comes from, forgive me, I'm going to butcher my Latin here. Hoc est enim corpus meum. The word, which is the words of the sacrament, for this is my body.
Mm.
And likewise, we know that abracadabra itself is
that's an old magic word that dates as early as the 2nd century, and presumably it's even older than that. It's just like we have our first recorded instance of it in the 2nd century, and that was a healing word that involved a triangle and amulets. So I mean, like, this is like this has always been there, this connection between religions, between the esoteric, between the occult, between misdirection and spells and incantations. Like, all this stuff is connected to one another, which is one of the reasons why Christianity was so strongly an exoteric religion. Exoteric being like, you know what the sacraments are, you know what things are not hidden. Things are not meant to be hidden, because this is the gift of everlasting life that comes to you from the relationship that you pledge yourself with God. Like, so that has to be exoteric. You cannot have an esoteric aspect to that if you want to have the gift of everlasting life to as many people as possible. But no matter how often you try to make things exoteric, the exoteric cannot exist without the esoteric to help define that. So the esoteric is always going to be constantly trying to creep back in. That's why the occult reoccurs time and time and time again, and it takes many different forms, and it hides its rituals in many different forms. Now, whether or not you believe that, many people do believe that, or they will act as if they believe it, which that in and of itself is a whole other can of worms, much like how with religion, many people practice religion without actually believing in it, and they act as if. What does it mean when people act as if? Well, sometimes you can fake it till you make it.
Yeah. And, you know, just an allusion to modern media, like with stuff like music videos, you can go, you know, people oftentimes, Christians who are sort of into this stuff, they'll go into they'll look at these websites, and they'll go down these rabbit holes of seeing that, you know, every major pop artist is like doing the like an Illuminati sign with like a triangle, or they have one eye covered or something like that. And people will go down these rabbit holes looking into Freemasonry and Satanism and all these things like that. And, you know, looking for this sort of hidden symbology in these videos, like, you know, like as somebody who is watching a magic trick will try to, you know, they'll be watching, they'll try to figure out what's happening, like what the shot is. Meanwhile, in these music videos, they're just full of, like, basically right in front of your eyes, they're full of just degeneracy of promoting like homosexuality and sexualizing young girls and race mixing and doing drugs and just like very sort of degenerate, like, you know, low existence lifestyles. And you got the trick is people who are looking into that, they get thrown down the rabbit hole of looking into Illuminati and shit like that, as opposed to just being like, wow, this is actually really sort of sick, the stuff that's being promoted here.
And that stuff itself can be a misdirection from what the actual elites are doing. Like, that's something that you guys talked about in Tedious, Alex, is that the conclusion being that largely a lot of this occult stuff seems to be a misdirection of some kind from who's actually, like, somebody's doing the raping.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a misdirection. We know who's doing the raping. And we also know that there's like a novelty appeal to stuff like satanic practices, things like that, occult beliefs, but does that mean that that's who's responsible? No.
Yeah, like, you know, True Detective season 1, Satanism is literally a misdirection. You know, they've got people chasing the rabbit hole of all this stuff, but it's really just meant to cover up this like mass cycle of child abuse by political elites and elites in the church and in the police department and things like that.
Yep. So I got one more thing to close this out on. I got a story for you guys. I think you might enjoy this. I think you'll get a good kick out of this. So I alluded that there's a lot of references to actual magicians and the like in this movie. There's a lot of little Easter eggs. Well, you remember the Chinese guy in the movie that's what inspires Borden, that he's living the trick, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So you got this theme of total devotion to the art of the facade and the trick becoming the mask, which we've already touched on that a little bit with the idea of obsession, and it's the only way of getting out of this, becoming someone else. These are themes of identity. Well, that Chinese guy was a real person. And I'm going to tell you the story of Cheng Ling Su and Cheng Ling Fu. So Cheng Ling Su was an actual person. He was born William Ellsworth Robinson, and he was an American from Westchester County. He got his he got his start in the vaudeville circuit and first got into magic LARPing as an Arab named Ahmed Ben Ali. Then actual Chinese man Ching Ling Fu, this guy was an actual Chinese man, Ching Ling Fu offered $1,000 to anyone who could replicate his illusions, because Ching Ling Fu refused to meet Robinson once Robinson figured out the tricks. And it's because like Robinson had taken another bet or so that he ended up failing on, so Ching Ling Fu had saw no need to meet with this guy. He just figured, like, nah, he couldn't have figured out my tricks. So he refused to meet with Robinson. Robinson got incensed about that. And after there was an advertisement for somebody, for people looking for a Chinese or Asian magician act, he decided, well, I know how to do this guy's tricks. I'll do it myself. So he pretended to be a Hapa and started living as an Asian man. And just like in the movie, he almost never spoke in order to maintain the illusion that he was a Chinese man who could not speak English. Nobody seemed to question the fact. It's like, wait a minute, doesn't he claims to be half Chinese, half Scottish, born in America, but he can't, he can only speak in broken English. And he does look like he's wearing a lot of makeup. It was like people like loved the act. Like he was LARPing hard as a half Chinese man, and he was living the act. He did all kinds of stuff like to live that as well. Like he had a fake wife and all of that. Like he lived the actual life to the point that people were fooled. And I'll just read this from the wiki here. So he got so in a story that echoes many elements of The Prestige, Ching Ling Su, remember that's Robinson Su, and Ching Ling Fu, the actual Chinese man, got into an actual rivalry as Fu knew who Robinson was and what he was doing, stealing his act wholesale. Fu was aware that Ching Ling Su was actually William Robinson and that he had copied virtually Fu's entire act. He publicly called Ching Ling Su an imposter and became intent on publicly exposing him as such. In order to garner publicity, Fu's promoter publicly announced that he would duplicate at least half of Ching Ling Su's illusions to prove that he was the real original Chinese conjurer. Su accepted the challenge and agreed to meet Fu at the offices of the Weekly Dispatch for a press conference. When Ching Ling Fu realized that the press was not interested in Ching Ling Su's real identity, he backed out of the press conference and the challenge. The episode was a public embarrassment for Ching Ling Fu, and who remained at the Empire Theater for only 4 weeks. Ching Ling Su's engagement at the Hippodrome lasted 3 months. Su's most famous illusion, partly because of his death while performing it, was called Condemned to Death by the Boxers. Now, that's a reference to the Boxer Rebellion that had happened only like a decade or so earlier at the time. In this trek, Su's assistants, sometimes dressed as boxers, took two guns onto the stage. Several members of the audience were called up to the stage to mark a bullet that appeared to be loaded into one of the guns. Attendants fired the gun at Su, and he appeared to catch the bullets from the air and drop them on a plate he held up in front of them. Actually, Su palmed the bullets, hiding them in his hand during their examination and marking. The muzzle-loaded guns were rigged so that the gunpowder charge fired in a chamber below the barrel so that the bullet never left the gun. After Ching Ling Su's death, the public was shocked to learn that he was not Chinese. Su's true identity was largely known among professional magicians. A year before Su's death, English magician William Goldston commented in an interview with Magician Monthly that the public did not question Su's identity because he has always presented to the public that which they like and not which he might prefer.
Very interesting.
Yep.
Yeah, so, people don't want
transracialism is a tried and true tradition.
So, as an Asian man, how do you feel about this poor story?
That's why I knew you guys were gonna get kicked out of that. as soon as I saw that, it's like he was LARPing as an Asian, like, oh my god, I'm getting really weird dissonance from this.
He was the original Duganist.
Ching Ling Dugan. It's a Ching Ling Suganist. I'll read this. If you guys want to hear a little bit more about, you guys want to hear a little bit more about the trick itself. We got a few minutes. I can tell you how the trick, a little bit more about how the trick functioned from, because I have this from the magic book. They talk about death of Ching Ling Su.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Why not?
Yeah. One of Magic's greatest stars, Chung Ling Su, died in a famous tragedy that was a dark chapter in Magic, an unfortunate mixture of trickery, explosives, and daring. Chung Ling Su was a renowned British music hall artist at the start of the 20th century. The public never knew he was not Chinese, but an American magician named William Ellsworth Robinson, born in 1862. Robinson never set foot in China, but found his calling by imitating genuine Chinese magic that he had seen in American vaudeville. Robinson shaved his head, dressed in Chinese robes, and never spoke on stage. As an Occidental's fantasy of an Oriental act, Chung Ling Su's concoction was even more extravagant than real Chinese magic. Again, like, we just do it better, I guess. Year after year, audiences came to see his artistic, exotic marvels. In 1904, he introduced his own version of the classic bullet-catching trick, which dates from the 1600s. Su presented it as condemned to death by the boxers, referencing a recent uprising in China that had made headlines, and he surrounded it with Oriental pageantry. Su was marched onto stage as it led to an execution. Two lead bullets were shown to the audience, and two spectators marked them by scratching lines or initials into the slugs. These were brought to one side of the stage and dramatically loaded into two old-fashioned rifles, along with a quantity of black powder and cotton wadding. Meanwhile, Su took his position on the opposite side of the stage, holding a dish in front of his chest. His assistants, dressed as Chinese soldiers, shouldered the rifles, took careful aim, and fired. The guns exploded. Su staggered as if he'd been struck. As he twisted the plate horizontally between his hands, the audience realized that they were hearing the bullets spinning against the porcelain dish. He stepped forward, obviously unharmed, and offered the bullets for examination. The spectators' marks were still visible. For 14 years, Chung Ling Su used condemned to death by the boxers as a special feature or to attract crowds and boost ticket sales at the theater. On March 23rd, 1918, he included it in his program at the Wood Green Empire Theater just north of London. At the second show that night, as the rifles were fired, stagehands noticed that the sound from the shots was extra loud. The audience watched as Su dropped the plate to the stage, let out a shot, and fell to the floor. "Oh my God, something's happened. Lower the curtain." They were the only words he ever spoke from the stage in perfect English. He was rushed to the hospital, but died the next morning, the victim of massive wounds from one of the bullets, which passed through his body and slammed against the brick wall of the theater. It was only after his death that his real identity was explained to the public, and his gun trick was analyzed by the coroner. In fact, Su had designed a trick rifle to fire a blank charge while concealing the bullet in a secret compartment. Over the years, the metal parts of one of the trick rifles had slowly worn away, so that the gunpowder had managed to trickle from one compartment to the other. On the fateful night, the powder ignited in both compartments, and Su was pierced by a real bullet. The tragedy was officially ruled death by misadventure. Audiences believed that they had been watching a bold Chinese wizard perform a death-defying trick. They never realized that Chung Ling Su had been playing a long, unwitting game of Russian roulette with his rifles. The advertising headlines and inevitable accidents only whetted the appetites of the public. It took ever-increasing marvels to lure them back into the theater. I always have on my mind the thought that next year I must do something greater, something more wonderful, Houdini once admitted. By the 1920s, a true master of magic was expected not only to display his powers, but to flaunt them by including a reckless dose of danger, challenging death. And I think that's a great point for us to kind of close out our final thoughts on this.
Was it like death by misadventure? Like, does that ever happen to joggers?
Each is the joggers that find the bodies, not be the bodies.
Was he trying to catch the bullet? I mean, you know, probably want to.
I heard he was an amateur electrician. Maybe he was also an amateur magician.
Yeah. Maybe he'd cloned himself. That was why he kept going back to check out the same house at night. You know, it's like the clone would forget about him previously being there and be like, "Oh, there's only a hammer here. There's no power tools."
But that was I hadn't read that part in the book, that full passage. That was a great closing part on that, because it really prefigures the need for spectacle. That, because magic eventually got, because a guy died on stage, doing the stuff, like the audience wanted greater and more dangerous spectacles. And in order to prevent people from dying, the spectacle has transmitted to simulation via media. Like, now the spectacle has become even greater. So I guess, like, my final thoughts on the Prestige is that I've squeezed blood from a stone in this movie. It's a fun movie. It's probably not as deep as I'm making it out to be, but I enjoyed it. I wouldn't mind recommending it. It's, if you like Nolan movies, check it out. If it's the one Nolan movie you haven't seen, it's worth, if you got 2 hours to kill, it's not the worst way to spend it.
I'll give it a 7 of 10.
Yeah.
Give it a 7.
Me too. I liked it. I would recommend it. It's not Nolan's best movie, but it's not a bad movie either. It's definitely better than most movies out right about now. And it could have been maybe like half an hour shorter. Yeah. But
definitely you could have shaved 30 minutes off this damn film easily.
Is there anything we did not cover that you guys wanted to cover?
Not really. Let me see. Scarlett Johansson's in there. Oh crap. Is there anything of no, I think we got it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I have some bullets I need to go catch. So with that, I'm going to push the pause button on this.